On the podcast today, we are joined by Alexandra Dumas. She is from South Africa, however, has been studying in the United States for a couple of years, and she is currently doing her MD PhD at Yale University. We are so excited to hear more about the program and more about her academic journey so far. To start, would you mind just telling the listeners about your academic slash research journey up until this point?
Sure. So we finished matric in 2019, which feels like yesterday, but it's actually a lifetime ago. And during that time, I had kind of decided that I wanted to apply to college in the US because I think we had a little bit of exposure to research in matric because you do that one research task or that ORT where mine was all secondary research, just like combing through papers and whatnot. But I think even from that, I had a sense that research was something I was interested in and something I wanted to do pretty early on. So I applied to a bunch of different universities across the US. And then March of 2020, you know, the world collapsed, but I also ended up getting into University of Pennsylvania, which is over in Philadelphia. Because of COVID, only moved there in like January of 2021. Immediately, I had already emailed like the professor I wanted to work with. At the time, I wasn't even in his department. I started as a neuroscience major, very quickly realized I was much better at solving equations and solving problems than I was at memorizing things, and switched into engineering. So started doing bioengineering. He's from Italy. His name is Dr. Riccardo Gattardi, and was very immediately, we kind of formed this bond, and he was like, of course, you know, when things open up, you're welcome to come join my lab. And when I was in his lab, I was working in the field of tissue engineering, which essentially is engineering replacement tissues for different parts of the body. At the time, that was cartilage tissue engineering. So I was working on engineering cartilage for the meniscus in your knee, but also for the upper airway in kids, because there's this disease called subglottic stenosis, which is essentially kids who have a tube down their throat when they're in the hospital for a really long time, their airway narrows in on itself. And sometimes it gets so severe that they can't breathe anymore. And so to open that up, they use a piece of cartilage. It used to be from the rib, then open the airway again. But as you can imagine, you don't really want to take a tissue from a kid somewhere else and then place it. So we were engineering cartilage to do that. As a result of that work, I got exposed to kind of this broader field, which we call biomaterials, which essentially means it's material science for the body. So in this case, I was engineering materials to make cartilage, and I was using pig tissue to do that, which is pretty cool. So essentially taking pig tissue, taking all the cells out of it, and using like the leftover scaffolding of the tissue to make new tissue. I thought it was cool. But all the while, I was taking a lot of chemistry classes. I was minoring in chemistry, which definitely is a story of, you know, learning to like something by initially being really bad at it. I like almost failed my first organic chemistry class. I was like absolutely distraught over it. And then I had a professor who just got me and I got him and fell in love with organic chemistry. And so that kind of pivoted this new interest in synthetic biomaterials moving forward. And that includes a number of things. So whether that's like someone in my lab was working on what we call hydrogels. So if you can think of like Jell-O, use them as like, she was using them for eye socket expansion for little kids who bought without eyes. Yeah, very cool. And I became interested in nanoparticles, which a lot of people became familiar with through the COVID vaccine, because essentially we can deliver drugs or mRNA or whatever that may be all throughout the body. So what I'm hopefully going to be working on this summer now is using nanoparticles and essentially engineering them so that they have different levels of what I would call surface roughness, but for lack of a better term, I'm going to call them, some of them are extra spiky and some of them are not. And what I'm really interested in is, can the body sense the surface roughness of these particles? That's relevant for a number of reasons. It's relevant, one, because when we're engineering these particles for vaccine science, for cancer immunology, for all these types of things, we want to know whether the body is going to attack the thing that we're trying to use to help it. And also, sometimes in the case of vaccines, we actually want the body to make a whole bunch of antibodies against whatever we did to save it. Yeah, so that's what I'm working on. But as you can tell, I feel like the beauty of research is the fact that it changes a lot. My cohort thinks it's hysterical, but I've gone from like cartilage to very much more in this immunology world. But I think especially early in your career, this is the time where you get to play a lot. So it's fun.
100%. So cool. And exactly that. I think so good to see the diversity that you can go into. And so being able to kind of figure that out along the way. That's also been really cool along your journey. And then now you are doing the MD PhD program. Could you explain just a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah, so when I was in college, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. I was like, I'm going to go to medical school. But there was always this part of me that knew that I really liked research. And I think the way I've been told this before now, being in an MD PhD program, is that that's normally a sign you should have been doing an MD PhD. Is that if there's like this major part of you that's like betraying yourself by not doing research. That's not to say that MDs can't do research. They absolutely can do very strong research and run labs. But in my case, I knew that I wanted a dedicated part of my training towards research, and especially in bioengineering, where the skill set I think is just so different to that of clinical research or clinical medicine. I definitely knew that I wanted to do a PhD. So I think my second year of college, someone said to me, well, have you heard of this thing called an MD PhD? And I was like, what's that? And so it's pretty cool in the sense that it's fully funded either by your university or by the government if you're American. I'm not. Essentially, the MSTP or Medical Scientist Training Program, which is another fancy way of saying an MD PhD, is intended to create people who kind of sit at the interface of medical practice and research. So a lot of people, say, for example, I have cohort mates who are going to become neurologists and they're actively researching treatments for Alzheimer's. Or in my case, who knows what I'll do clinically, potentially something pediatric surgery in the oncology space while researching new immunotherapies for kids. So it's kind of like we sit, hopefully, to bridge the two places, because I feel like research and medicine sometimes exist in these two spheres where it's difficult for them to talk to each other. But I mean, it was a big decision, I think, because it's 8 years of your life. Med school is 4, PhD could have been 4 or 5. And I think it ultimately came down to that feeling of like, I can't give up one or the other. But yeah, being an international student at the time, it was complicated to apply because there's only so many places that are willing to fund international students. And I when I applied, I had many people tell me, you know, don't hold your breath, apply to PhD programs. And then if the MD PhD doesn't work out, you can go back to med school after. So I did that. I applied to 17 PhD programs, 13 MD PhD programs. I did a bunch of PhD interviews. And then still hadn't heard anything from an MD PhD program. And then got this email from Yale, my October of my last year of college. Immediately was like, that's insane. That's not real. I called my parents crying the whole time. Yeah, what's happening? So really, I found out I had an interview. I interviewed and I told myself, like, this is your shot. You got to go for it. And so, yeah, and here we are now almost at the end of my first year at Yale, which is still surreal to me. But we're meeting the new admits 2 weeks from now, which is really cool.
Fantastic. Such a wonderful journey as well. I think cool to people, for people to hear. Also being from South Africa, and even though it can be tricky kind of figuring things out, being in the States, it can still work and have be such a wonderful experience, which is so good. And at the end of your 8 years, do you then get the option to choose whether you want to be a doctor or if you want to be full-time research or kind of, as you say, that mix between the two?
Yeah. So at the end of the MD PhD, there's a couple of ways you can go. We have more medical training depending on your specialty. So that's called residency. And then if you want to do even more on top of that, there's a fellowship. So you apply to residency. And in that case, you can either apply on a straight clinical track, which means you're full-time doing medical practice, or you can apply along a physician scientist track, which is more common in some specialties than others. Some specialties are still kind of growing their ability to do that. But that means you get split research time and clinical time. And then the last route is if you decide you've done all of this and you're like, I'm actually not going to practice any medicine at all, which some people do. Either you can go straight to faculty positions if you feel that you have the resume to do so, and apply, or you can go do a postdoctoral fellowship somewhere else in another lab for a few years, until you feel like you're at the point where you can have your own lab. But honestly, there's a couple people who just graduated from our program who are working in venture capital or who started their own companies out of their PhD research. So I think there's just like so many ways you can go from there.
Which is great also to keep that door open. As you say, with like research being a passion, to be able to still have that incorporated in the program and then as an option later on, is a fantastic thing that you don't also have to make a decision so early. You can kind of figure it out as you go, which is really cool. And I know you've said obviously that research component is something that you love, and so great to still be able to do that. But also just along with that, either your experience in your program or from conversations or an understanding of the world of medicine, where do you think that research and what place do you think research holds in aiding, whether it's patient care, treatment, diagnosis? What's your opinion on that?
Okay, that's a really good question. I think that there's two sides to this question. I went to a talk last year, I think it was, by Drew Weissman, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine with Katalin Karikó last year, or the year before, I forget. But he was posed a similar question, which was, is translational research, being research that directly impacts clinical care, or basic science research, which is how does this protein channel do what it does, and these types of questions, which are more important? Which at the time I was like, both are important logically. And he argued that basic science research is the foundation for all translational research. Both are necessary, but we can't forget about these fundamental research questions, which, when posed that way, made a lot of sense to me. So I think the place of research, regardless of what you're doing, I mean, I have friends who work on zebrafish, right? It feels so far. They're looking at like specific genetic diseases in zebrafish. It feels so far from the bench side, or from any hospital setting. But I think the reality is that like any questions we can kind of answer in that setting, hope if you're not doing it to hopefully inform clinical care one day, then what are you doing? But I think, at least, especially in my work in engineering, engineers kind of work backwards from a problem and then go forwards. So I look at a clinical picture and then what am I trying to solve here? So I think the two are completely intertwined, but I definitely would think that given that I'm doing both. But yeah, I think you can't have really good research without a clinical mindset. Like the number of people I've met here who just observed something in the clinic. They were like, I think someone was telling me they watched neonates in the 90s who were like dying from, I think it was hypomagnesia or something like that. And essentially she started doing research on why was that they couldn't cope with that. And started all this cool research about how the kidney works and neonates and why it's different. But all of it comes from either observing something clinically or observing something in the lab that's directly relevant. So I think the two should talk to each other if, yeah, in both directions.
And exactly that, I think also the way that your program is structured is also so cool. It allows people to also ask those questions, ask why am I studying what I'm studying? Why am I researching what I'm researching? And then obviously for those to go hand in hand does make perfect sense. We have a world in which there's so much, which is amazing on a global scale as well, but there is so many efforts continuing to be made to improve patient care, to understand more. I think doing a little bit of research in my honours as well, and which is like very small, but you start to realise actually how many unknowns there are. And so a lot of people feel that, and obviously there are millions of diseases, but knowing how close we are to an answer or to a cure or whatever it is, there is a global effort it to be able to try and make patient care better. So it's really cool just knowing that that's happening, also being able to kind of be a part of that and figure it out along the way, which is really cool.
I mean, I think ultimately, to be frank, I think the reality of research can be very difficult. You know, like they will go, you know, say I've spent a month in the lab and then I figure out everything I did actually contradicts what I thought before, or, you know, you spend a whole weekend coming into the lab to work with your mice and then something goes wrong and your whole experiment isn't valid anymore. So I think, like, at least for me, the thing that you have to be anchored in the fact that there's a clinical reason or some other reason that you're doing this. Otherwise, you know, there's the days where you're in the lab and you're wanting to pull your hair out just wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah, you need that motivation beyond just what your project is. Absolutely. Yeah, so good. And exactly as you say, very true. Research is not always an easy thing. And so obviously I think people's idea of studying medicine is always very high, which it is, because obviously we're understanding how our bodies work, we're learning so much about it. But also from a research perspective, it's not an easy career. It's not an easy component. And so it's really great both. Yeah.
I think it's also research is a lot more creative, I think, than people maybe can originally see, because you're always asking a new question and thinking about something from a new angle. And it's very easy to kind of get this imposter syndrome where you're like, well, my question isn't as good as this person's question, or this person answered the question way better than I could have answered the question, which maybe it sometimes in clinical practice happens less, because you can be a very good doctor and a very bad doctor. Let's not get that twisted. But I think there's more of a sense that there's like a thing that you have to do in a certain way, whereas in research there's a lot more like fluidity in that, which is both the reason everyone loves it and the reason that it gets tricky to do.
And still on kind of speaking about research, how have you found collaboration or mentorship has aided you throughout the years?
That's a really good point. I think when I was a first or second year in college, I had a professor who said to me, you can't have one mentor. And at the time I was like, what do you mean by that? I think this was before it became like, you have to have a team of mentors, like kind of like on social media and everyone talking to you. But I think it was the best piece of advice I had. So I had like my research mentor who was a graduate student. I had my research mentor who was the professor. Then also had a clinical mentor who was a pediatric surgeon. I think something I discounted until later was I had selected several people who were just outside of my field of research who were female, because there actually weren't as many females, at least in engineering and in engineering research, and then more so in surgery as well. So I think that was a very, very big thing for me, because, you know, it's one thing to say to like my professor, like, oh, I'm going to go do an 8-year degree. It's another thing to have someone who knows me as a woman as well say to me, okay, I know you really prioritize your family and seeing them, and like, how does that factor in? Or like, if you wanted to have your own family, have you thought about that? What does that look like? So I think having mentors who understand you intellectually and personally is really important. Also, just from, you know, and it's, I hate to use the word networking, but I think it's true. I had my professor that I worked under for research was very pro-networking. So every time I went to a conference, he said, you know, you meet people and then right after this, you send them an email, you say, this is what you spoke about. This is why it was great to speak to them. And I think what ended up happening when I applied to grad school then was I could then reach out to those people and be like, hey, you helped me with this thing. I'm applying to your university, or I'm doing this. So I think your reach of mentors can never quite be like big enough, in my opinion, as long as you are clear about who your like go-tos are.
Collaboration with other researchers, have you experienced that? Do you find that it's very beneficial for you and for them, of course, as well?
Yeah, I think especially in engineering, it's a very big thing, because normally in the lab that I work in here, it's like we collaborate with someone more clinical, because like we've developed some system where we want to develop drugs to go to this part of the body or that part of the body. And we have to then collaborate with someone who is an expert in, say, the liver or the kidney or these types of things. In my experience, I collaborated with actually he was a physician scientist when I was an undergrad. And it was the first time I'd like had a surgeon come to the lab and like practice surgery on this like tissue that I was working on with me. And I think what you get out of that is completely different perspective, in the sense that especially when you're doing translational research, you as a researcher are like, I think it's going to work this way. And then he came into the lab and he was like, surgeons are not going to like that. You can't do that. You need to do it this way. And I think especially collaborating with clinical people, it gives you like the practicality side of things. Because in research, we sometimes live in la la land and we're like, this is amazing. This 14-step procedure is exactly what they're going to do. And then you meet a clinician and they're like, no, I need 3 steps. 14 is great. So I think the reality check of collaboration is important. But also sometimes, I went to an orthopedics conference like my senior year. I was working on still cartilage at the time, but there was someone there who was working on like metabolism and like metabolic differences in men and women with osteoporosis. And it like completely opened this different avenue to think about development of these bone cells, development of cartilage cells, all these types of things that I would never have thought about if I didn't talk to someone outside my field. So I think I read a book. It was Katlyn Kariko's book like last year. And she literally talks about she just read everything and anything. And I think there is an importance to that. Obviously, I have cohort mates whose PhDs are in neuroscience. It feels like Greek to me most of the time. But every now and then, reading something in that world, I think, gives you a new perspective on what you're doing or a new way to look at something. And I think the times we do things in science that are novel are usually because two people from two different worlds were like, I like that thing you're doing, and you like what I'm doing. Like, let's do it together.
So good to always be open-minded as well, as you say, to have those conversations, to read something that isn't or doesn't feel relevant to your research at the time. But you don't know what kind of new avenue it opens up for you, or a conversation or relationship that it starts that then becomes on the end. So really cool. Maybe just even two more questions. The one is just like over your research career, what has been your biggest challenge that has helped you grow as a researcher?
The challenge is two, I guess I can think of two. The one is that, like, kind of alluding to the imposter syndrome thing that I spoke about a bit earlier, especially because I think when I started doing research, I was 19. Everything is super exciting in Europe. Like, everything is amazing. And then you start doing it for, like, I think the project that I eventually ended up graduating on, I worked on for 3 years, which by research standards is not that long. But even within those 3 years, I was like, oh man, like they're doing something really cool and I should change this to be cool. And oh man, like there's like this sense that you kind of like, you love what you're doing, but you have to have such a firm belief in what you're doing, because otherwise the will to just abandon it and do something cooler and shinier and prettier is very much there. And I think something I've had to work on a lot is having the confidence to stick with it and keep going, even if it's not perfect, because I think that is the problem. The more you research something, the more you find its holes and its flaws. And so you kind of have two paths there. You either have to say for this publication or this paper, directly address them, or you just have to, write the paper admitting to the flaws and saying this to the field, this is where we have to go next. So I think that's a challenge. The second is just the speed at which things happen, especially as new people going into research, starting research. It, you know, I was under the impression, and I think it is partially true, and I think South Africans are pretty good at this. If you work hard, you will get results, but they're not always going to be the results that you want. You know, like I can run like as many experiments as I want in a day, but at the end of the day, if the protocol is not optimized, if something's not working, the data will exist. It just won't be very good. And so I think reconciling that you have to keep working hard, because the more you work hard, the more you're going to have hits. But there is a slow process of, like, I remember I had a 2 month period where I was just optimizing the same protocol, not getting any new data because I was just trying to figure out how to do something. And I think the wrestling with yourself of not moving forward and feeling frustrated in that is a pretty big challenge. But especially, I think it gets harder in graduate school where you're like, ah, if I don't finish this, I'm not going to get a PhD. But I think there's two strategies that I use to grapple with that. The one is just keep on keeping on. The other is if I'm working on one thing for a really long time, maybe it's wise to start a second thing in tandem that's intellectual relief in some way. So if there's like an easy win experiment I know I can do, and I've had like 4 days of failure, I will absolutely do it. It's a small serotonin is what I call them. It's like the little thing you do just to like pick yourself up so you can keep going.
Yeah, we need that motivation sometimes for sure. So really good just seeing kind of how you also cope with those. I think it's very real that there's a lot of highs of any career and also some lows. And so kind of figuring those out and still enjoying and being passionate about what you do is what it all is about, which is really great. And then the last question, just if somebody is wanting to pursue the career that you have kind of gone down or wanting to do like an MD PhD program, what would you say to them? What would you encourage them in?
I think the one thing I would encourage them to do is to just keep being curious. I think I remember there were times when I was younger where I would constantly be like, why does that work this way? How does it work that way? And people were like, you're so irritating, stop doing that. And, you know, people would be like, just like, shut up and accept that that's the way it works. And I think the voices telling you to stop doing that are lying to you. If your brain wants to keep asking questions, don't stop asking questions. And I think that I wish I'd owned that more. I think there were times where I definitely just kind of went, oh, they're right. Like, I'm being a nerd, I'm being weird. I need to like control that. But really, your ability to focus on questions and whys and hows are what makes you, I think, want to go down this field. The other thing I would say is just talk to people who are doing it. I think I didn't do it until later on, and I regret that because I think I was nervous of them. Somehow I was like, they're doing this thing. The reality is the people who are doing what you want to do, be that an MD, PhD, an MD, a PhD, anything, a master's, honors, anything, they also were the person being like, how do you do that? What does that mean? You know? And I think, at least for me, like when I chat to like pre-meds now, I'm like, here's my number, like text me if you need anything. And I think most people are very willing to do that. So just like stick your neck out. The worst they can do is say no, that they're busy, and that's fine. As long as you accept that they're busy. But I wish that earlier on, I hadn't let the fear of like, oh, they're so busy and I don't want to impinge on their time. Like, they wished someone had spoken to them too. So just don't be afraid to reach out and don't be afraid to look stupid. I think half of asking questions is like, when you sit quiet, it's because you're scared someone's going to think you're dumb. But even if you look dumb, like, at least you answered the question for yourself. Like, I feel better when I look dumb sometimes because at least I'm like not stressed about the question anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's so good. And so important to also just, as you say, remember that everyone who is doing what you want to do was once in your position and wondering whether they wanted to or not. Ali, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. We really appreciate you sharing some of your research journey so far. It is amazing to hear about the program and to understand a little bit more about the research that's being done there, but also just to see that there is a continual effort to have an impact on global research and how that kind of translates to the clinical space. So thank you so much.